Les colloques du Collège de France.
I'll start by saying happy birthday, Stan. I can't believe you're turning 60. I also can't believe you're only 60, based on all the work presented here over the last couple of days. I've known Stan for almost 20 years, and he's always been a great source of inspiration. In fact, when I started my lab about 15 years ago, I essentially copied his paradigms and made some modifications and went with that in my initial few experiments. I've never really worked on GNW, unlike many in this room, but I've always really enjoyed comparing my empirical data with GNW predictions, and that in itself has been a great source of ideas. So I have been obsessed with the question of how conscious visual perception happens over the last 15 years or so. The neuroscience textbook picture still is very much centered on the feed-forward processing pathway, where we know that neurons in successive stages of processing in the brain extract more complex and abstract patterns, information from the visual input. And the power of this feed-forward framework is mirrored in the wild successes of the deep convolutional neural networks referenced multiple times yesterday. In DCNNs, units at successive stages of the network do this linear, nonlinear canonical operation very much like what neurons do. And these deep convolutional neural nets are very successful at image classification and object recognition tasks. But I would like to try to convince you today that there are several extra feed-forward influences without understanding which we have no hope of understanding conscious visual perception. And these include intrinsic, also called spontaneous brain activity, which is going on all the time, top-down feedback, and memories. Let me give you some examples to illustrate these concepts. First, many of you know that the brain is only 2% of the body weight, but consumes 20% of the energy. More than 95% of that energy is spent on maintaining the constantly ongoing spontaneous activity. And through the resting state network revolution in fMRI over the last two decades, we now know that spontaneous activity is incredibly organized spatial-temporally. Disruption of that organization has behavioral, functional, and clinical consequences. We also know that spontaneous activity has very large amplitudes. So our conception of how the brain processes sensory input needs to move away from this picture of throwing a pebble into a peaceful pond, but more into a picture of throwing a pebble into the roaring ocean. It's really in that interaction between the sensory evoked activity and the ongoing spontaneous activity that our percepts are generated. Top-down feedback, as many of you who have studied neural anatomy know that the feed-forward pathway is really puny in terms of the anatomical weights in the brain. So even in V1, as Douglas and Martin showed many years ago, the vast majority of the synapses are not contributed by the feed-forward pathway. The feed-forward pathway accounts for less than 1% of the synapses. The vast majority, 99%, comes from either recurrent connections, horizontal connections within V1, or top-down connections. And thalamus has been a big part of this this conference so far. Even in LGN, a first-order thalamic nucleus, less than 20% of the synapses come from the retina. 80 to 90% of the synapses come from top-down feedback from V1. LGN does not have its intrinsic horizontal connections, so it's either feed-forward or top-down. So top-down is massive, just in terms of the anatomical weight. I would submit to you that I think our understanding of the computational role played by top-down feedback in visual perception is still at its very beginning. And lastly, memories. So as this Dalmatian dog picture illustrates, memories automatically and powerfully influence our perception, often without us noticing. So the first time you saw this picture looks like meaningless patterns, and once you recognize that dog in the picture, from then on, you always recognize the dog. This memory's impact on perception is happening very fast, without us noticing, and very automatically and powerfully, without us being able to override it. Today, I'd like to share with you three lines of experimental work using different paradigms where we have come back again and again to these concepts of spontaneous activity, top-down feedback, and memory. The first line of work uses the age-old vestibular visual perception paradigm. We have been using this face-face illusion, Nyquist cube picture, to study the neural correlates of conscious perception, which can be dissociated from the physical sensory input in these cases. Here are just a few other fun examples. In a recent study, we put healthy volunteers in the MEG scanner and asked them to use buttons to indicate which percept they are experiencing at a given moment in time when they fix their eyes at the center of the Nyquist cube or face-face image. And we found that if we extract the slow cortical potentials, which is the low frequency range of the 1 over f aperiodic activity, some of you know that I worked on 1 over f activity prior to entering the consciousness field. Slow cortical potentials are the low frequency range of this 1 over f slope. These are power spectrum plotted in a log-log plot. And at higher frequencies, you start seeing these oscillations, like alpha and beta oscillations. In multiple experiments, not just this one, we found that slow potentials gives us a pretty good signal for decoding the content of conscious perception. For example, in this paradigm, we find that right after one button press to right before the next button press, so different trials are rescaled here from 0% to 100%, so we can plot them together because they have different lengths. But throughout this percept duration, we can use slow cortical potential recorded from MEG whole brain activity patterns to predict whether people are seeing this view or this view of the Nyquist cube. But using higher frequency ranges, alpha amplitude, beta amplitude, or filtered higher frequency activity, we could not decode the conscious content. So what do these higher frequency oscillations do? We found a really nice functional double dissociation here, which was that when we extract the alpha amplitude over time, that amplitude predicts how long a particular conscious percept was going to last over time. We reproduced it in MEG, in EEG, across different data sets. This is just an example from my example participant to illustrate this point. Each dot is from a single trial. When the alpha amplitude is high, the percept tends to last longer, which makes some sense because alpha indicates the level of cortical inhibition. And in biophysical models of vestibular perception, when you increase inhibition, the brain tends to stay in one of the percept longer. It's like if you think about it as a double well attractor network kind of model. So this suggests that there are separate frequency channels in the field potential that encode the content of conscious perception or promotes the stability of conscious perception. And as I mentioned, we have multiple experiments across different paradigms that show the same essential findings that I won't have time to get into today. Another thing we did with this Nyquist cube Rubin face-face paradigm was to probe how lifelong knowledge influences perception. This picture illustrates this point well. We tend to see these circles as concave and these ones as convex because we have the lifelong experience of light comes from above. Incidentally, a few days before this trip, I asked my 7-year-old and 4-year-old what they see out of these pictures, and they actually don't see those depth cues as I do. Each circle can be seen as concave or convex. So from my N-of-2 highly non-rigorous experiment, it seems like it's really lifelong experiences that drive these priors, these particular kind of priors. It also fits with the observation that these priors are quite stable within an individual. If you bring a participant back multiple times, they tend to have the same level of bias. And we show that in the supplementary data in this paper. I forgot to mention that in the Nyquist cube condition, even though the Nyquist cube is symmetrical, people tend to perceive this view more often than this view because the throughout our lives, we tend to see a cube sitting on the floor rather than hanging in the air. And people have tested individuals with autistic spectrum disorder using the same task with an echo cube, and they find that this perceptual bias tends to be much more diminished in the autistic individual, suggesting that their perception may be more biased towards the actual sensory input. Okay, so I wanted to understand what's the neural mechanism of this lifelong prior knowledge's impact on perception. There had been two competing hypotheses that make opposite predictions about this. One is a hierarchical predictive coding idea, which suggests that these priors should be encoded in higher order brain regions and influence perceptual or sensory processing through top-down feedback. And the prediction error gets sent forward, and the circuit iteratively reduces prediction error. Another idea, before we did the experiment, I thought was equally plausible, was that for this lifelong prior knowledge, which they call the context-independent global priors, they are encoded in the bottom-up information processing apparatus, such as the coding properties of V1 neurons. For example, it's known that V1 neurons tend to be tuned more to the cardinal orientation than the oblique orientation. That may be one type of lifelong prior. Of course, there is a question of nature versus nurture there. So here, using the Necker cube paradigm, we asked, do we see neural activity consistent with a top-down implementation of the prior or the bottom-up implementation of the prior? We ran the task in patients implanted with intracranial EEG electrodes, and the patients performed the same task, and we used Granger causality to probe directed informational influences between electrodes, and we found that in the ventral visual stream, but also extending between visual regions and prefrontal regions, there was a much stronger top-down influence when people perceive the preferred view that is consistent with their lifelong prior knowledge. And whereas when people perceive the alternative view, there was much stronger bottom-up input. And this was pretty parsimoniously explained by a model we implemented that basically combined attractor network models with hierarchical predictive coding elements, where a top-down prior knowledge biases perception through this top-down feedback. This does not mean that lifelong prior knowledge or global priors could not be implemented in bottom-up processing apparatus, but it at least shows the plausibility of top-down to implement lifelong prior knowledge. So in this first line of work, we found double dissociation in the frequency domain between, between brain activity that supports the content of conscious perception and that promotes the stability of conscious perception. And top-down feedback can implement lifelong prior knowledge to bias conscious perception. Okay, so in the second line of work, this will dovetail with some of the other talks so far in this workshop, we probed the threshold mechanism in the brain, determining whether a piece of sensory information enters awareness or not. So here, we were specifically interested in object information that is not more potentially more ecologically meaningful. Here we took these object images, which could be one of four categories, and presented them very briefly at a weak contrast at the individual participant's perceptual threshold. Participants consciously recognized the picture in about half of the trials. And we asked them to first perform an alternative false choice question about categorization of the image, and then tell us just subjectively whether they recognize a meaningful content in the picture or not. We also presented them with these scrambled pictures, which were face shuffled, and they preserved low-level image properties that differed between categories, but they were devoid of any meaningful content. So they are pure noise picture. And here, when people answer, yes, I recognize a meaningful content, it's a false alarm trial. In fact, we have behavior evidence showing that they are actually experiencing genuine false perceptions here. The first thing we did was we took these real images that were attached to a particular participant's perceptual threshold. So the same picture is presented across trials, and we asked what's the difference in the brain activity patterns when people perceive that meaningful content, a dog, or when they just see noise patterns. And we found that the same set of large-scale brain regions are activated and deactivated. You see visual regions and frontal parietal networks being activated both in the conscious recognition case and when recognition failed. And you see the default network deactivating in both cases. And in subcortical regions, this was a 7T study, we also found similar activation-deactivation patterns in thalamus, basal ganglia, and brainstem. Interestingly, in these brainstem nuclei, including dorsal raphe, locus coeruleus, VPA, and pedunculopontine nucleus, so basically all the neuromodulatory centers, we found heightened activation when people successfully recognize image content. So first, this shows, again, echoing the message that has been voiced several times here, subcortical regions really matter for conscious perception. And second, it shows a picture that's slightly different from the classic pictures that was put forward about ignition. It does not seem like it's a stochasticity in the feed-forward network, feed-forward pathway involving higher-order regions. That's how you get conscious perception. But these regions are activated, deactivated in both cases. But we did find a qualitative difference that was distinguishing between conscious recognition and lack of conscious recognition. And we found that in the information content in these brain regions. So here I'm going to show you these cortical regions, activated ones on the right and deactivated ones on the left, subcortical regions in the center. And I'm going to show you how well we could decode what category the stimulus was. And again, all of these results I've shown you so far are using the real images only. And we found that when people reported successful object recognition, we could decode the stimulus category, both in the activated brain cortical regions and in the deactivated DMN regions. And when they reported they could not recognize the object in the picture, there was no decoding in any of these regions. So there was widespread content-specific information in both activated and deactivated cortical networks. Interestingly, in subcortical regions, even though we saw that there was heightened activation, we could not decode even in the recognized trials. We controlled for ROI size and a bunch of other things. So it seems that subcortical regions implement this generic information poor switch-like signal accompanying conscious recognition, whereas cortical regions have the information-rich signal accompanying conscious recognition. Okay, what about the false perceptions elicited by these scrambled pictures? We found that they were accompanied by especially strengthened, not weakened, strengthened engagement of higher order brain regions. In the two prefrontal regions, dorsal anterior cingulate and this inferior frontal junction, involved in like object-based attention, if you are familiar with that literature. So those two regions have heightened activation when people are presented with scrambled pictures, and default network regions shown in orange have heightened deactivation. This is not just a task difficulty signal, because we could decode essentially the category of the false perception in the scrambled picture trials. So our hypothesis here, our model, working model, is that these higher order regions send a top-down perceptual template to try to decipher this especially crappy, noisy picture. And that top-down template can sometimes trigger false perceptions. Okay, so I mentioned earlier that spontaneous brain activity matter. So we wanted to understand how pre-stimulus spontaneous ongoing activity interact with that sensory evoked activity to generate conscious perception. And our starting point here was to ask, can we use the pre-stimulus activity to predict the success or failure of conscious recognition? So in this task, we could leverage the powerful signal detection theory because real pictures triggering a yes, I recognize something would be a hit, and scrambled pictures triggering yes, I recognize something meaningful, that would be a false alarm. So we could calculate criteria and D'. And briefly, criterion tells us the propensity of a participant to answer yes versus no. Higher criterion would be more conservative, and people would answer recognition less frequently, so fewer hits and fewer false alarms. And higher D' would mean that you have a higher hit rate without a concomitant increase in false alarm rate. So the separation between noise and signal distribution is greater. So we asked, could we use pre-stimulus activity to predict people's criterion and sensitivity in their conscious recognition behavior? I'm going to use one slide to summarize some old MEG study, this paper published in 2019, which was that using a multivariate classifier applied to the pre-stimulus activity, we could extract two different spontaneous activity processes that influence conscious recognition in different ways. One of them we termed non-content specific process. This activity is high when people's pupil size was larger, so it's linked to arousal or correlated with arousal. And this activity influenced conscious recognition regardless of whether the picture was a house or animal, regardless of the content of the picture. So we call it non-content specific. And when this activity is high, people tended to adopt more liberal criterion. So they had more false alarms and more hits. Whereas we also found a type of spontaneous activity processes that were content specific. So one activity pattern promoting a particular kind of recognition for a particular kind of images. And this activity promoted higher sensitivity. So when this activity was high or matched with the sensory input, people tended to have higher sensitivity. So they had higher hits without increase in false alarms. And so this was MEG study, and we didn't know where were the sources of this intriguing spontaneous activity. And I want to share with you a more recent fMRI study where we really probed where in the brain the spontaneous activity influenced criterion versus sensitivity of conscious object recognition behavior. And here we used fMRI activity recorded in the volume before stimulus presentation. Without so what this means is that I guess I'm glossing over some of the technical details here. So the fMRI activity was recorded in the volume before, in physical time, before the stimulus was presented. So there was no chance, no possibility of post-stimulus activity contaminating the spontaneous activity we were analyzing. And we also did some analysis to remove any potential contaminating activity from previous trials, and the inter-trial interval was very long in this study. So it was a pretty clean measure of spontaneous activity. And we found that in the pre-stimulus period, the spontaneous activity in visual regions and a couple of prefrontal regions, orbital frontal cortex and ventromedial prefrontal cortex, influenced criterion. So when the pre-stimulus activity was high in these regions, people tended to adopt a more conservative criterion. So they had fewer hits and fewer false alarms. Whereas in a set of regions that roughly corresponded to the singular opercular network involved in the regulation of arousal, this anterior portion of posterior cingulate, and thalamus and insula, we found that higher pre-stimulus activity promoted or predisposed subjects to adopt a more liberal criterion. So they had more successes with conscious recognition, but they also had more false recognitions, false perceptions. We also looked at which brain activity influences sensitivity. We found that primarily in default mode network regions, so VMPFC and this retrosplenian cortex that's known to be connected with VMPFC. So in these regions, higher pre-stimulus activity allowed people to perceive the real pictures and scrambled pictures more differently. In other words, they recognize the real pictures better without a concomitant increase in false alarms. And strikingly, VMPFC across the entire brain was the only region that allowed us to, this was all corrected for multiple comparisons. After multiple comparison correction, was the only region that allowed us to predict both sensitivity and criteria in the pre-stimulus activity. So this is a lot of regions. How do I summarize this? How do we make sense of it? This table basically summarizes all those patterns I just showed you. And we also dug into the mechanisms of these pre-stimulus activities' impact on conscious recognition. I'll just share with you what we found with VMPFC and visual network. We found that with VMPFC, when the pre-stimulus spontaneous activity was high, the evoked activity had less trial-to-trial variability. So that means that the sensory evoked responses is less noisy. And remember, this was a threshold level perception task. So if we use SDT modeling, it's like the signal distribution is right-centered around the bound, decision bound, because it's 50% seen, 50% unseen. So if we put this kind of assumptions in an SDT model, automatically we get increased sensitivity and more conservative criteria, exactly matching our empirical observation of what happens when VMPFC spontaneous activity was high. What about visual network? We found the opposite pattern, which was that when visual network spontaneous activity was high, sensory evoked activity was noisier. There was larger trial-to-trial variability, specifically in the visual regions. And this pattern actually matches some of the monkey electrophysiological, neurophysiological recordings. And so our idea here was that when pre-stimulus visual cortical activity, spontaneous activity was high, sensory evoked activity was noisier. So downstream regions adopt a more conservative criterion to avoid excessive false alarms. So that was a hypothesis based on this pattern. How do we test that? The first thing we did was that if the trial-to-trial variability was high and sensory evoked activity was noisy, that means that stimulus decoding should be poor. So we tested that. Indeed, we found that when pre-stimulus visual cortical activity was high, we were less able to decode the stimulus category from the evoked activity. So fitting with this idea that higher pre-stimulus visual cortical activity degraded stimulus decoding. So that should predict that behaviorally, people should perform worse on the categorization task. So we went back to the behavior data, and indeed we found that to be the case. When pre-stimulus activity in the visual network was high, indeed categorization accuracy was poor. And what about this idea that downstream regions adopt a more conservative criterion? Some of you know that there is literature in monkey neurophysiology suggesting that the basal ganglia is involved in setting the decision criterion. And so we looked into evoked activity magnitude when pre-stimulus activity in visual network was high versus low. And we found that when visual network pre-stimulus activity was high, there was reduced evoked response in the basal ganglia. And there were some optogenetic findings in monkeys showing that activating basal ganglia triggers more liberal criterion, exactly fitting with our finding here that basal ganglia activity reduced and people tend to adopt a more conservative criterion. So to summarize this part on the pre-stimulus activity findings, we found that pre-stimulus activity in multiple large-scale brain networks going far beyond the visual network impact whether we consciously recognize a sensory input or not, including visual network, including the MPFC, and including the singular opercular network. I don't have time to go into today. So very quickly, back into electrophysiology, I mentioned that we have found that SCP is a frequency band that allows us to decode the content of conscious perception especially well. We have also done a series of work using multiple paradigms showing that spontaneous pre-stimulus SCP activity influences conscious perception. We can decode whether people will see or not see a stimulus in these threshold paradigms up to 2 seconds before stimulus onset using SCP. A recent study in our lab probed whether SCP and alpha oscillation, which is well known to also impact conscious perception in the pre-stimulus period, whether those two act through common set of influences or the act on perception independently. And both activities, both alpha power and SCP activity, have been found to be able to influence the criterion of conscious detection. And in this study, I don't have time to show you the results, but to just give you the take-home message, using two different data sets, measuring the perceptually relevant SCP activity, perceptually relevant alpha oscillation power, we found that there was no trial-to-trial correlation between the two, suggesting that these different types of spontaneous activity have independent influences on conscious perception. So to summarize this second line of work, conscious recognition is supported by information-rich cortical activity in both activated and deactivated regions and information-poor subcortical activity. At least that's what we found here. And false perceptions appear to be driven by top-down feedback, and spontaneous activity influences conscious perception, and we are starting to tease apart the mechanism of how it interacts with that sensory-evoked activity. And these findings also give us some ideas about what might occur in hallucinations. We are hypothesizing that hallucinations might occur due to overactive top-down or maladaptive spontaneous activity, which are also ideas that have been floating around in the literature. And we are currently testing these ideas in neurological populations. So lastly, memory. So inspired by the Dalmatian dog picture, we created pictures like this in my lab a number of years ago. If you've not seen this picture, I've always used the same pictures in my talk, so you probably have seen it. If you've not seen it, it's probably very difficult to recognize. And now if I show you this picture, many of you will see this one as a dog. And here are just some other examples. Here's another example. And here you go. And another example. And here's the original picture. Many of you will see that helicopter, and last example. Okay, so people's accuracy in identifying these pictures really shoot up, and it's a long-lasting effect. You bring them back to the lab many months later, they still recognize that picture, and if you show the same, we call these Mooney pictures, if you show the same Mooney picture multiple times, recognition rate remains high, you show them the original picture, it shoots up. It's a really dramatic one-shot perceptual learning phenomenon. And the gray curves here are one, a grayscale picture, the original picture did not match, just to control for repetition. Studies have shown that patients with hallucinations, including both psychotic patients and neurological patients who experience hallucinations, have a hypernormal learning effect on this task. So their learning magnitude is bigger than the controls. So that's blue on the left and yellow on the right. And this fits with the idea that hallucinations are at least partly driven by prior knowledge's overweighted influence on conscious perception. So what's a brain mechanism for one-shot perceptual learning? When we started this line of work, the most default hypothesis in the field was the hippocampus. So a very quick review of the memory system. Hippocampus is known, most famous for supporting fast memory acquisition, episodic memory, semantic memory, and the cortex and striatal system is famous for slow, deliberate learning. These graphs probably should be updated. We now know that hippocampus is also involved in statistical learning. But by and large, the idea is that hippocampus is really critical for fast, one-shot learning. So we tested whether hippocampus is required for one-shot perceptual learning by testing some of Larry Squire's amnesic patients. These are the five patients we tested. And as you can see from the MRI, there are these black holes where the hippocampi used to be on both sides, both hemispheres. All patients have been extensively characterized by Larry's lab. They all have amnesia. And based on the MRI volume loss, it was estimated that they had near total loss of hippocampal neurons. Let me show you the behavior pattern in controls first. This is the identification accuracy for the Mooney picture prior to seeing the matching grayscale picture. A day after, shoots up, and 7 days after, 5 months after, it's sustained. This is the pattern we had known. Lo and behold, the patients were intact in this task. So here you see that they also have the one-shot learning, and it's also sustained. And we think initially controls do a little bit better than patients because they had the benefit of episodic memory, which degraded here over time. The white dot is GP, who had especially severe amnesia, but was also intact on this task. And as you would expect, but also extremely strikingly, if we change the task just slightly, instead of asking what's in this picture, which is the, what this task is about, we ask them, have you seen this picture before, changing it into an old, new remembering task? Then patients are substantially impaired, as you can see here. Black bars are the controls, gray bars are the patients. On the left is the naming task, one-shot perceptual learning task. On the right is the memory task. Okay, so when we have shown it's not the hippocampus, the neural cortex implements this fast one-shot perceptual learning capability. So where is it in the cortex? We did some fMRI studies to try to hunt this down, and I'll just summarize the finding for you here, which was that we found that changes in neural activity from pre to post stage extended far beyond the visual system, in early visual cortex, high-level visual cortex, frontal parietal, multiple demand network, default mode network. All these networks, we found that the similarity between a grayscale picture and a post picture was higher than between a pre-picture and a grayscale picture. And actually, Nancy did some beautiful work in this using this paradigm that we left in V1 especially. So we validated that V1 finding, and we showed that we found it elsewhere in the cortex as well. And then we did a couple of other studies. So we have been hunting the question of where that plasticity is stored in the brain. Because just because we see activity changes in all these regions doesn't mean that the brain stores memory in all these regions. It would be quite non-economical for the brain to store a copy of the memory in all these regions. But rather, it would be stored in some region, and once that memory is reactivated, it can have widespread impact on the network. So this is a difficult question to answer because we can't image the synaptic connectivity pattern changes, right? Because all of our techniques gives us the active neuronal dynamics. We can't image the changes in the synaptic connectivity. So we try to hunt this down through several approaches. First, we asked what kind of information is stored in that prior knowledge by manipulating the original picture. And we could ask what kind of manipulations does not disturb learning and what kind of manipulations abolish learning. And then we also asked, using intracranial recordings, which brain region has the earliest onset activity difference between pre and post stage. The idea is that the brain region that encodes a memory should have the earliest onset activity difference between pre and post, because it reactivates that memory, and then that can have impacts on the rest of the network. And lastly, we try to build a deep neural network model to recapitulate the learning effect in humans and then ask the information learned by the model, which brain region it's most similar to. So I'm going to skip the first experiment using psychophysics and just show you the second and third one here. Using intracranial recordings, we really did very widespread sampling across visual and higher order regions, including limbic circuit dorsal visual stream, DMN, FPN, frontal parietal network. And so in this graph, we are plotting the high gamma power in response to the pre-pictures, moni picture in the pre-stage, shown in blue, and moni picture in the post-stage, shown in orange, and the grayscale pictures shown in gray. The black bars show when we see a difference between pre and post. And we found the earliest difference in high-level visual cortex, so essentially IP, earlier, much earlier than early visual cortex. We did not find a significant difference in the dorsal visual stream. We found later difference in frontal parietal regions, presumably due to downstream decision-related activities. But this is just generic activation. It's not very specific. So we also asked, at an electrode-to-electrode level, when do we see in the neural activity a shift in the post-disambiguation stage towards the matching grayscale picture? So in other words, we probe the similarity between the neural activity in a grayscale picture stage and the post-disambiguation stage, image to image. And we found that that similarity increased in the post-stage only in the high-level visual cortex, more significantly than the significantly higher than the pre-stage. And we did not find a significant difference in the early visual cortex, although there was this elevated similarity. You would expect that, but not a significant difference between pre and post, and we did not find that in higher order regions. So this pretty much narrowed it down to IT cortex for the earliest change in neural activity before versus after learning. And we did not find important changes in limbic circuit or DMN. Okay, so this is my last couple of slides. So we also implemented a DNN model to try to perform this task. As many of you know, one-shot learning remains one of the holy grails in machine learning AI research. A lot of the one-shot learning effort in that community has been inspired by episodic memory. But as I've shown you, one-shot perceptual learning is really a different capability that the human brain possesses. And my collaborator Eric and his student Chris implemented this vision transformer model that is augmented by top-down. So vision transformer itself uses a self-attention mechanism that's similar to LLMs, but across image patches of the same image input. It by itself does not have the sequence learning or history-dependent performance that you see in LLMs. We implemented this prior storage mechanism that accumulates information over time and uses that information through top-down mechanism to guide the visual processing in this network. And we also tested other models like recurrent convolutional neural networks, BLT, CONNET, that could not do this task. And just to show you the behavior performance of our model, it has a one-shot learning ability almost matching human learning ability. So at 41% increase in accuracy to 31%, it's pretty good. And critically, the model recapitulated people's error patterns. So in other words, we asked across trials between two human subjects, how similar are their behavioral patterns? So do you and I see the same picture successfully? And that's shown in the middle bar here. And the right bar is between our model and different human subjects. So you can see that at the single trial level, the error pattern similarity our model is matching up to human between human similarity pretty well. And now with the model in hand, we can ask the prior information learned in the model, which brain region it is most similar to. And we found that the prior information learning in the model, we could extract that by using this trick where the grayscale picture matches or not matches with the Mooney picture. And extracting that prior information in the model from this prior storage module, we compared it to the fMRI activity representation in the human brain. And we found that it uniquely had a high correspondence to the neural representation in IT cortex, so here, fusiform gyrus. Okay, so to summarize this last part, one-shot learning is implemented in the human brain by the neural cortex, and we think this plasticity happens in IT, and we are starting to tease apart the computational and network mechanisms here. To summarize, I believe conscious perception comes from the interaction between the bottom-up sensory evoked activity and top-down brain activity, between the bottom-up sensory evoked activity and the spontaneous ongoing activity, and it reflects our interpretation, our brain's interpretation of sensory input in the context of past memories. And I'd like to stop with thanks to the people who contributed to this work. Their names are in yellow here, and thank you for your attention.
Collège de France. Le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.